welcome to another edition of Five of the Best. First of all, I'm going to say that this is the last one I'm going to be doing every week. I'm going to be doing them every 10, 11 days. It's summer here and I've got other things I'd like to do. This one is going to be about 1958 and a few things that happened in 1958. And in 1958, the Space Aeronautical was formed. NASA was formed in 1958. If you're British, there's one other thing that happened in 1958, and that is the Busby Babes air crash, Munich air crash. This is when a generation of football players, I mean, this is proper football players, yeah, not like American football players who wear tights, proper football players, and they're Manchester United football players, and they were set to dominate football for the next 10 years. And unfortunately, you had the Munich plane crash, which killed 8 of the team. And I'm amazed that some of these sports teams fly all the time. It shows how safe flying is, really. Anyway, what else happened in 1958? In China, 1958 was not a good time. It would have been the start of a Chinese famine, which started in 1958 and continued to 1961. And this was a combination of natural disasters and poor planning. And it was caused the death of 30 million Chinese. In the cinema, you would have seen Bridge of the River Kwai, South Pacific, Gigi. King Creole, I've never heard of the King Creole, I'll look that up, and Vertigo, and also Elvis Presley started his 2-year service in the army. In 1958, the F-104 Starfighter held a number of records simultaneously. It held the altitude record, which was 92,000 feet, and it also held the speed record at 1,400 miles an hour. And I'm going to talk a little about this plane because it's quite a remarkable plane. And if you see pictures, it's very much of a 1950s plane, and there will be pictures on the site. The plane was built basically because of the Korean War, and the Russian MiG's Vantage, the MiG-17s, were far superior than the American pilots had, and the Americans demanded or wanted a plane which was a fast-flying, high-altitude plane, which would get the advantage back over the MiGs. And as a result, the F-104 Starfighter was built. It was built by Lockheed, and they came up with the idea. And by 1954, they won the contract, and people were very sceptical, because if you see this plane, it has the wings are 7 feet long. And people were wondering whether it would even get off the ground and what sort of load it could be able to lift with those wings. But the plane was a huge success, and it's flown all around the world by different countries. And the first one was built in 1952, and the last one built was in 1984. And they were still in service with the Italians until 2004. In 1958, some people might be shocked by the fact that if you wanted to turn the TV on, you had to walk over to the TV and turn it on, or change channels and then walk back again. This happened all the time in 1958, but it was starting to change when Zenith introduced the first, it wasn't the first remote control, but it was the first really reliable remote control. Zenith had released earlier versions of the TV remote. In 1953, in fact, they released the Zenith Lazy Boy, and this was just a cable running from the TV to the couch. And the obvious problem with that is if you wanted to make a cup of tea, it was a trip hazard. And Zenith had made an improved version of this called the Flashman, which looked like a gun, and he used to shoot a beam of light to a photosensitive cell on the TV. The main problem with this is that if you left the room with a TV on, off, and you probably came back at the end of the day, you'd find that the TV would be on, because if the sun came in through the window, it would turn the TV on. If you're watching the TV, the sun will change channels. And in 1958, Zenith came up with the product, and this remote control used infrared, which we use today. The way that infrared works is it sends out a Morse code like signal but through light, and if you have a digital camera, you can actually see the pulses from the remote control. And in 1958, all this technology could increase. So you, if you purchased the set, if you wanted a remote control with it, that would be, could be as much as $80 for the remote control. With our modern lives, we have multiple devices in which we want to control with remote control, and at the moment we have multiple devices or multiple remote controls. And one way around this, one solution would be to use Bluetooth, which is becoming increasingly used. In fact, the name Bluetooth comes from King Harald of Denmark and Norway, and he was a tribal leader who united the local warring tribes and brought peace and prosperity. In fact, he actually brought Christianity to the area. And the name Bluetooth, one theory is that he used to like to stain his teeth blue with blueberry juice, and the other is that the name Blur, or Blue, or as it's pronounced in Denmark, represents dark, and the theory is that he was either dark haired or dark skinned, and that would have been very unusual in Scandinavia. The way Bluetooth works is it is a short range radio system, and it transmits over 2400 megahertz, and there are 80 channels in Bluetooth, starting at 2400 and going up to 2480, and you've got 2401, 2402, 2403 up to 80, and Bluetooth channel hops between these channels. And it does this incredibly quickly. In fact, it's every cycle, it goes every second, it does this cycle 1600 times. And each portion, each channel, it can transmit 1 meg of data. So in theory, there could be 80 devices in which you control. At the moment, you can only control 9 devices with Bluetooth, but we'll see where the future goes with this. In 1958, a product was invented which would change the world forever. The story really starts when 8 bright young scientists quit the William Shackley labs. William Shackley was considered to be a god in the electronics world at the time. He actually was the co-inventor of a transistor, and he actually won the Nobel Prize for his work on the transistor. And it was William Shockley who, with this fame, handpicked 8 young scientists to start his own labs. And the problem with William Shockley that he was, his man management was awful, really. He would give them tasks and within 2 or 3 days ask how well they were doing. And at one time, when a girl office worker was caught her hand on a door, and he thought that this was a malicious action, and he asked all 8 of the scientists to take lie detector tests to see who did it. Even I know if you don't ask 8 bright scientists to take lie detector tests for something as trivial as that. Anyway, things got to a head, and I think the working conditions and the lie detector was the last straw, and the 8 scientists left William Shockley, and they were known as the Treacherous 8 at the time. And they had actually arranged, they actually had money for new labs from William Fairchild's. And the 8 won the group. The last person of the group to join the group was their leader, and that was Richard Noyce. He still wanted to work with William Shockley, but he was convinced to join the group and film Fairchild Semiconductors. In fact, they all signed a dollar bill, a famous dollar bill, to start, which is on this website with all their signatures on it. It was about this time that a guy called Jack Kilby started to work, who was working for Texas Instruments at the time, and he wanted to put his idea together, which was to an integrated circuit in which the transistors, capacitors and resistors would be put into a semiconductive material of the size of a postage stamp and something we would now call a microchip. And as he was doing this work, Robert Noyce was also working on his very similar idea product, and it was Jack Kilby who came up with the first microchip. If it's a picture on, it's a picture on a website, and it is a very crude microchip, but you call it a microchip all the same. Jack Kilby then went put his idea into pattern in 1959, and Richard Noyce did exactly the same thing 7 weeks later. The Patent Office decided that the two ideas were basically the same, and they had to be given as joint inventors, and that is what it has happened. Jack Kilby and Richard Noyce are co-inventors of the microchip. But Jack Kilby's design or patent is very different to Richard Noyce's idea. Jack Kilby wanted, or all he did was miniaturized the capacitors, the resistors, and the transistors, and he put wires in between them, and he put them into a semiconductive material. But there were little tiny wires connecting all of these products, and this was extremely difficult to make, and people who have made it have found it that it is no better than the products at the time. Where Richard Noyce's idea was to use lithography, which means that he had a flat silicon base and you could produce hundreds of microchips at a time, and that is what he's done today. In fact, the microchip design has 90% to do with Richard Noyce's idea and very little to do with Jack Kilby. And yet it is Jack Kilby who won the Nobel Prize, and I think it's believed that you have a Jack Kilby Day in America, where the true inventor, in my view, is Richard Noyce. Richard Noyce went on to form Intel with one of the other Treacherous Eight, and Jack Kilby stayed with Texas Instruments all his life. On February the 5th, 1958, the US Air Force lost one of its nuclear weapons, and this happened when a B-47, which was on a simulated bombing mission over America, was intercepted by an American jet which was trying to intercept the plane. A Sabre 86 struck the bomber, and this caused the Sabre pilot to eject safely, and the bomber had to look for emergency landing. And on doing this, he thought he was going out over to sea. In fact, he was going over Savannah, and he dropped his bomb there thinking it was over sea, but in fact when they looked back and they thought that the bomb landed within 5 miles of the city. In 1958, in the 1950s, this was not an untypical situation. This is rather alarmingly, fighter pilots and fighter bombers were going out with live bombs, live nuclear weapons, and doing simulated runs over New York, Pittsburgh, all over the country with live bombs. Upon discovering that it was over the city, the US Air Force spent 2 months looking for the bomb, and finally they never found it, and they've declared that it was safe. But is it really safe? In Scotland, there was a storm and an arms deposit was washed up on the beach, and there were 40 arms ammunitions on the beach, and of the 40, three blew up, and they were over 80 years old. So this has only been gone, what, 60 years? Can it really be called safe? Well, I hope so. To lose one bomb, well, that can happen to anyone. To lose two, well, that's unfortunate. But what do you call it when you lose 11? Because that's what the 11, that's what the Americans have done. In another event in 1961, when a B-52 crashed while refueling, releasing its bombs, one, this is over marshland, and one was recovered and one is lost. And the one which was recovered, it was found that of the six fail-safes to stop the bomb blowing up, it was found that five of the gates were open and only one was closed. So this is considered to be the nearest that a nuclear bomb has come to exploding over America, and it was dropped by Americans. This is another story of a nuclear bomb being dropped in 1958, a few weeks later after the first one, and it shows that no matter how many clever fail-safes you have, they can be undone by human stupidity. This was a B-52 flying a mission, and it had some technical difficulties, and the pilot went down to check that the bomb was still in place, and he wanted to make sure that the locking pin was still secured, and he asked the bombardier to go and check, and after a few minutes he decided that he could not find the locking mechanism and it must be on top of the bomb. So he decided to climb on top of the bomb, and for use of a handhold, he managed to grab hold of the emergency release lever, and in which time the bomb released and hits the bomb bay, the closed bomb bays, the bomb bay doors, and the three-ton bomb bouncing on the bomb bay doors caused them to fail, with the bombardier still on top of the bomb. Anyway, the bombardier managed to scramble himself half out of the aircraft aft in, helped in by others, and the bomb then plummeted to earth, narrowly missing a house, and the explosion caused, or the way that the bomb, a nuclear bomb worked at the time, there's a plutonium, a ball of plutonium, and that's encased by an explosive material, a TNT, and that TNT is detonated, causing the plutonium, which is about a grapefruit size, to be about a tennis ball size, and which time this is a critical mass in which the chain reaction, a chain reaction occurs, and that basically is a nuclear explosion. And what happened was, is the fortunately, by pure luck, because some of the bombs were had the plutonium in the bomb and some of them didn't, but on this occasion the plutonium was stored somewhere else on the plane, and it was just the explosive material which exploded, still leaving a 70 foot crater. But it's just pure luck. You can see pictures of the bomb site and where the bomb landed on the website.